You pressed play on this podcast with the click of curiosity. It is another dimension, a dimension of mind, a dimension where nothing is sacred and everything is explainable. You're streaming into a land of both inside and outside, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the midside.
Welcome to the midside, where we're not diverse because of Zack Snyder or Tom Brady or Ayn Rand for some reason. I don't know. I don't understand anymore. I'm your host, Justin M. Wisniewski. And if you are sick of my whiteness and my maleness, too bad. I can't change it. What do you want me to do about it? What do you want me to do about it? But you know what you can do about it? You can tell a friend about it. Hey, here's this really straight white male podcast. We need more of those nowadays. Don't listen to me, but listen to this podcast. Joining me this trip, some people you may want to listen to, from our nation's capital, Daniel T. Richards.
Does that mean the half Mexican in me is not welcome here?
No, you are, but it doesn't count.
Oh, it doesn't count. No, just like Obama being half black didn't count.
Right, exactly. It only counts when it serves an agenda, and it doesn't serve the agenda because you support Tom Brady and Zack Snyder and Ayn Rand. Therefore, it doesn't matter that you're half Mexican. You might as well be white.
Yeah, that's fair enough. Sound logic.
The video that I'm in of talking to Zack Snyder, which went around on Twitter. And directly across from me, there's a black guy, and someone replied to the video on Twitter and goes, "Oh, look, a meeting of all white people."
I thought that the video pans very quickly, but I thought literally the first person the video pans on is darker skinned, and I thought, nah, someone didn't watch the video too closely.
Yeah. Well, but also there's my girlfriend, a Filipino girl, talking to a Japanese guy also in the video. So,
yeah, and they don't count.
Okay, so we've learned something today about what counts. The Asians don't count as diversity. So,
no.
Speaking of diversity, you'll understand with this long-winded intro. From Dale's Lawn, identifying as a woman to forego his gay white male privilege. So I think we're trying to add some diversity here, William Green.
Hello, hello. Yeah, the April Fool's jokes are coming early this year. I saw you guys follow me on Twitter, at LaForge. Apparently Tinder
don't
is
plug
introducing,
yourself.
introducing a thing you never asked for, but definitely always wanted: Tinder height verification. So Justin, will you be verifying your height on Tinder?
Well, seeing as how I have a girlfriend, no.
I don't know about your polyamorous you relationship. I'm not judging.
Also, why do you think one of the reasons I prefer Asian girls?
So you can be taller than them?
That's one of them. I'm not lying.
Well, I'm sad that Tinder is discriminating, so I think I'm going to lobby Grindr to do penis size verification. So you can people will stop lying about their penises.
What standard are they using, though? Are we talking like the Adam Carolla? Like, what is it, Daniel? The dip in the water? Are we talking like bone pressed?
Water displacement?
Water displacement, bone pressed. Are we factoring in the curve here? What standard?
I don't know. That's a great question. We'll have to settle on that. I'm sure the algorithm will solve it for us.
So other than Adam Carolla's water displacement theory of how you should judge how you compare to other men, have you heard his how you should measure yourself down there theory, Justin? Other than the water displacement one,
I've only heard the jacket thing that we should all be given jackets once a year to know where we rank.
He says if we're not going to do water displacement, that there's only one legitimate way to measure your genitalia as a man, and that is you get a piece of string so that you can lay it on a ruler later. You start the string at the center of your anus. You wrap it twice around the testicles, don't get greedy, to just past the tip.
Sounds about right. Sounds about how things would be done.
Yeah, just past.
Still more accurate than guys on Grindr.
I'm sure there are some really great stories behind that comment. Unfortunately, we are not that podcast. We are the podcast, though, about all the dicks in the world. So let's move on to that in the news with Daniel T. Richards.
isn't just a fad.
Well, before we get to the farce that is the news this week, I want to remind everyone that we have a Patreon page, patreon.com/themidside, and Patreon is where you can go, yes, you, and give us a few bucks every time we produce a piece of content. It really helps us do things like keep lights on. I keep lights on all the time when I record this podcast, and so I need your money to do that. But sincerely, we appreciate it, and you can check us out. We have exclusive content there for our Patreon subscribers. But on to Stephen Colbert. Justin, you're going to have to fill in some of the blanks in this incredibly poorly written story. Since
did you watch the video?
There. I don't watch videos of Stephen Colbert.
Okay, well, you had to watch the video, but that's fair. I'll fill it in.
Okay, so Stephen Colbert, this is the title, Stephen Colbert goes off on Zack Snyder for saying Batman and Superman kill. The Late Show host and noted comic book fan feigned outrage in response to recent comments made by Batman v Superman Dawn of Justice director Zack Snyder, who said viewers preferring their superheroes be kept innocent are, quote, living in an effing dream world, end quote, when he appeared at a three-night event that featured a showing of Snyder's director's cuts. Colbert said, Zack, these are beloved children's characters. Aquaman sells opiates and the Flash is a human trafficker? Walk it off. The whole Justice League is addicted to snuff porn. Grow up. Snyder's stirring comments came in response to a fan who asked about the brutal tactics of Snyder's burnt-out Batman, played by Ben Affleck, who was seen unrepentantly killing criminals as part of his gloves-off method of crime fighting. So this is what Snyder said, a little bit of extended quote. Someone says to me, Batman killed a guy. I'm like, F yeah, wake the F up. I guess that's what I'm saying. Once you lose your virginity with this effing movie, and then you come and say to me something like, my superhero wouldn't do that. I'm like, are you serious? I'm like down the effing road on that. It's a cool point of view to be like, my heroes are innocent. That's cool. But you're living in an effing dream world. Justin, could you fill in some of the gaps here for the listeners?
Yeah, which gap specifically? Because there are a lot of gaps to fill in here.
The one between his two front teeth. No, I don't know.
Get braces.
So what is the context of Snyder's comment? Let's start there, because okay, it does sound a little out of character for Zack Snyder.
Well, it is a little out of character. That's the first thing. There's two important contexts here.
There was only one backtrack that's a little cool, bit. First of all, so we clearly know it's out of context.
True.
Well, how do you know it's out of context? That's what he says to introduce anything he says.
Well, there's only one. There should be like seven.
He was missing the other cools he repeated eight times. Yes, I swear to God, he's a bed from Community. Where he's just like, cool, 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 cool. No, the first thing is Stephen Colbert in his video drops so much context where he's just like, oh, you know, Batman kills, get over it. Superman kills, get over it. The context of this quote is, first of all, he was in a room of about, I don't know, 300 to 350 people who were his fans. So he knew he could speak in a more relaxed manner, which is a whole other discussion I want to return to in a second, Daniel, the whole social media world we're living in. So let's hold on to that. So that's the first thing, is his mentality. The second thing is, this was on the second night of three director's cut screening. It was on the Watchmen night. And somebody asked him about the Watchmen influence on Batman versus Superman. And he was talking about how he started with Watchmen, and then because of his approach to Watchmen, how that affected his approach to Batman versus Superman. And we know in Watchmen, it's all about all these flaws and how corrupt all of these heroes are, these superheroes are. So that's what he's saying. He's like, if you're starting from Watchmen, then I'm already down the fucking road. And people are dropping that context. They're saying, you know, he's just saying that in general, Batman and Superman kills. No, he's talking about in his movie, in relation to Batman versus Superman, in that movie, in relation to Watchmen that they kill. And he's saying in this movie they kill, just get over it. That's this way this movie is approaching it.
Right. So, William, is there, you know, to sort of bag on Zach a little bit here on the show, we won't do it much, but just a little. Is he creating some sort of strange false dichotomy here between goodness and not killing? Because I don't see anything inherently wrong with Batman killing a criminal. Do you?
Well, it's certainly different than it's something that is part of the character journey for Batman. And I think it's important. It's like, how is Batman different than like a character like the Punisher or Arrow or someone like that, right? Like there is like some historical contrast there, but I think it's more important to focus on Colbert's argument, like as an argument. He's saying like, these are beloved children's stories. Has he seen the modern comic book industry and how they're destroying and hypersexualizing characters, all the woke versions of our favorite childhood characters? When people who are against when people stand up to defend their beloved childhood characters for being consistent and not being woke and feminized and put into the camp of social justice, they're told to get over it. So maybe we should just use that argument against Colbert. He should just get over it. These aren't childhood characters. These are artist creations.
Justin?
Well, that's 100% what it is. And clearly they're doing this because of the agenda. And I want to answer Daniel's question to you first before I use that to transition into the thing that I find much more interesting here. I don't want to equate, and I don't think Snyder was equating, innocence with good and killing with bad and being non-innocent with bad. I think that's all he's saying is these characters, his movies, are about what's really going on in the world, the ideas that are really at stake, the conflicts that are really at stake. And that's where the lack of innocence is. That's what Watchmen, he's saying, is that Watchmen becomes grounded in actual conflicts, not these hypothetical conflicts where they create these false worlds where it's these superheroes are able to be self-sacrificial, right? You can create a Superman that's altruistic and self-sacrificial if you're ignoring human psychology. But Man of Steel and Batman versus Superman don't do that because Snyder himself said he grew up on Watchmen and Frank Miller's The Dark Knight Returns. And that's what he's meaning by innocence. He's not meaning good versus bad. We even see that with his take on Watchmen. And that's something I'll talk about in a later day. You know, he does say the morality in the book and the movie are the same, but he's not talking about the guilt or innocence there. That's this is really what the heart of it is. Do you understand what I'm saying, Daniel, that he's not equating innocence with bad or with good?
Yeah, I think I get that. And I think that's a nuanced distinction. Certainly you don't get that from the quote that's given here, but I suspect that the quote that's given here is truncated, and it not only is it truncated, but it's part of a 3-day discussion between him and his fans. So,
right. Well, and they did that intentionally. And that's the more interesting thing here, right? Is exactly what you just said. This is a 3-day discussion with his fans, and they take one little sound snippet, and they put it on a national late night talk show. Daniel, I'm baffled by this. I am baffled as to how this is worth talking about.
I want to know who is watching on the Colbert staff. Who is watching a Vero stream of Zack Snyder?
Well, that's part of it, too, is they're not watching the Vero stream. They're watching the responses to the Vero stream. So it becomes like a game of telephone at this point as well, which is another thing to have in this discussion. So people watched it. People took the quotes out of context, then other people started repeating it, and then people started repeating that repetition. But even if you're repeating it and you find out, oh, well, on the first night there was like 200 there, and on the second night there was like, well, there was maybe 200 the first night. There was, you know, about 300 the second night, and then there was the full 500. The whole audience was full. The whole theater was full the third night. At what point do you go, though, this is a director raising money for his school, and 500 people were there at most. This does not mean anything important in the entire world. This was literally, Daniel, one news cycle is 24 hours now, but this lasted the whole week on Twitter to the point that it made it to the Colbert show on like Wednesday night. Can you please explain to me? Is this just our culture? Explain to me what's going on. Is this just our culture being broken?
I think it's being broken. I think Zack Snyder represents an attack on this naturalistic nonsense Hollywood that we're all supposed to buy into, this social justice idea of film and ideology. And Zack is making movies that are romantic and idealized and show heroes and take serious the ideas that are presented and don't make a big joke out of it like Marvel. So he in some way is a threat. And I think Colbert, of all of the late night people, is sort of the most intellectual of them in the sense that he's the one who's most ideologically driven by this social justice BS. So of course he sees Zack Snyder as a threat, and of course he would do something on it because you got to bring down anyone who doesn't conform.
And that's the world we're living in, and it's kind of scary. I mean, I don't know how you guys feel about it. Maybe you can talk a little bit about that. But it's kind of scary that you can't even talk to 500 of your closest friends up in the hills in LA, up in Pasadena, and not have people go after you for it. I almost wonder if the live stream was a mistake.
Maybe, but I don't know. I mean, it speaks to him that he filled an auditorium of 500 people and then had people watching on the live stream. So there's clearly a market for this, and Colbert knows that, and it's got to go, according to Colbert.
But does it bother you guys? Does it worry you guys that there's no more sort of privacy? And what I mean by that is, I'm not saying there's anything to hide, but don't you long for the days where you could go to like a Star Trek convention and everything you did there wasn't reported on the internet? That was like a shared experience you had with the people there, and the people who didn't go didn't give a fuck because they decided they didn't want to go. Now, even if you don't go, you're still concerned about what happens at places like this. Like WonderCon is down the street from me right now. I literally don't give a fuck what's going on at WonderCon because I decided not to go.
Point of interest, Justin, I have been to more Star Trek conventions than I have Star Wars conventions.
Wow.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. 1-0, in
fact. I don't know, Justin, I see it as a bit of a false dichotomy because I enjoy the fact that I could see...
No one's ever thrown that at me in the show before, by the way. Good job.
I enjoy
the fact
that...
You're going to hit me with
the
bro!
False dichotomy, bro.
Thank you.
I enjoyed the fact that I got to watch you on camera via Vero and participate in the parts of the, you know, the experience remotely. And I think that's the power of the internet, because we know the power of LA traffic to prevent me from getting down there. So I think that it shifts us to be more aware of context, because like you were saying, you don't care, and I don't care either. When I see things on the news or in the media or on Twitter, I don't immediately think that is correct. I the first question I have is, oh, where is this coming from? What's the context here? And I think that's the new world we live in, that we have to have more emphasis on that. I think that we had to be concerned about it before, but we have to be even more concerned about it now. Is the context being manipulated?
Well, I think the answer is, in the modern era of social media and 24-hour news cycles, the context is almost necessarily distorted. And because that's how they drive attention. I mean, we call it clickbait, right? But that is right now the model for getting people to go to your website, is how can we drop context?
Well, right. And that's what I told to somebody on Twitter. They, you know, all the Snyder fans, I'm more connected with them now. And they were all talking about this Stephen Colbert thing. And I replied to one person and I said, this is a clickbait joke about a quick clickbait headline.
Yeah, totally. So context is more important than ever. And we need to, as people who defend values, and especially our people who share our values, we need to make sure that we don't do that sort of thing. And we need to make sure that we judge people based on context. You know, if Zack Snyder had said this in an academic paper, you'd judge it very differently. Or if he said it in a book where he was giving his theory of aesthetics, you'd judge it very differently. But it's an off-the-cuff answer in a Q&A in a room of people who are Zack Snyder fans. You have to judge that in that context. You have to. Otherwise, you are being intellectually dishonest.
Well, and it's also a question about Watchmen as well. I mean, first of all, I don't think Zack Snyder would ever write an academic paper. I don't know how he would get through a sentence without the word cool.
The cool theory of art.
Yeah, the cool theory of art. It's 100%. You know, he was like, oh, this person asked about Watchmen, so I can go into my Watchmen state of mind. I mean, you look, dude, you saw how relaxed he is in the video where he's talking to me about Sucker Punch. Like, the way he is able to change based on context was so amazing to me. The second he saw me in that Sucker Punch shirt and I told him I wanted to ask a question, his demeanor changed and he became instantly more relaxed because I was willing to talk about that film. It was just something about that changed in his mind.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, by the way, he said it was obvious that the dragon baby, when the throat was being slit, was a phallic symbol. So just thought I'd share that with the listeners.
Man, we've been sharing a lot of phalluses with the listeners so far.
Well, this next story doesn't have any phalluses, but the one after, maybe. So speaking of people who don't conform, that was going to be the transition I used 21 minutes ago. Trump administration is going to charge Facebook with discriminatory housing advertising practices. This comes after Facebook settled a lawsuit with the ACLU over the exact same practice last week and overhauled its advertising as a result. Nonetheless, in a civil complaint, the Department of Housing and Urban Development is seeking damages for any person who was harmed by Facebook's targeted advertising policies, which until recently allowed employers and landlords to limit their audiences on the basis of race, ethnicity, or gender. A senior HUD official told CNBC that based on Facebook's user base and the proliferation of housing ads, the agency expects the number of users affected by the discriminatory practices could number in the millions, gentlemen. Facebook holds out that its advertising Facebook holds out its advertising platform as a powerful resource for advertisers in many industries, including housing and housing-related services, says the complaint. But because of the way Facebook designed its advertising platform, ads for housing and housing-related services are shown to large audiences that are severely biased. Justin, show me on the computer where Facebook housing ads touched you.
Oh, that was a good one. That's a really good joke. I like that one. I mean, Facebook touched me, and right now I'm touching my forehead and I'm touching my heart because that is where Facebook has. Also, I'm touching my genitalia. just to continue the.
But
theme
that's
of the
just
show.
A continuous thing. Like that's just a.
It's isn't like that the I'm purpose leaving. Of
He's
Facebook?
Al Bundy.
Yeah.
No, it's touched me on my head. It's touched me with my heart, right? It's really messed me up psychologically, and it's really messed me up emotionally. Daniel, to me, this story is a perfect example of why the right sucks as hard as the left. Shouldn't any housing group, any housing complex, any Facebook user, let's just expand it to Facebook users in general, shouldn't they have a right to target their advertising to whoever they want? I mean, now isn't this just severely, if we take this principle, right, this precedent that's been set here, doesn't this make it so the limits of advertising are very, very small now? You can't design a commercial. You can't put your advertisement in certain magazines, on certain websites, on certain radio stations, before certain movies. You can't have product placement in certain movies. Because you're trying to target certain audiences. Well, let me give an example here. Not that there was anything in a Jordan Peele movie, but we're going to be talking about Jordan Peele later. What if somebody had said, I want to target the black demographic for advertisement, so I'm going to advertise, I'm going to say something stupid, grape soda in Us. God. That would be illegal now based upon this precedent. It doesn't only apply to half. So this seems incredibly, incredibly, incredibly anti-freedom to me. And
well,
it shows
Justin,
how much the right
Justin,
sucks
this,
and that is left.
I think you're right, but a little history here. This comes from the Fair Housing Act. This is like a 60s, 70s like law, right? This is from the Civil Rights era. So this is a long time law.
So they're just applying a law that sucks?
Yeah. I'm just making a point that this you're right about the precedent talk. And maybe you can make an argument that we needed something like that. We had huge, a lot of discrimination happening in the housing market. We all know the story here from LA about the Hollywood sign that no one wants to talk about the real history of the Hollywood sign. But it's interesting.
You're
to
just
me.
Gonna leave that there for the listeners. You're not gonna explain it.
Ah, no, they can Google it.
All right,
you want to explain it?
Google it. No.
Then why are you asking me to?
Because I don't know it. I was trying to do it in a clever way to not look like.
I want you to look like a jackass, though. That's what this show's about. So the Hollywood
grape soda, William. Grape
is,
soda
is Hollywood Land. It was a gated community for whites only. That's how it started, and that was supposed to be a whole suburban neighborhood up there, and the sign was part of its promotion. And yeah. this comes from a pretty racist time in American history. Now, to me, it's interesting because, you know, Facebook is supposed to be so woke, right? And here they are doing something that even Craigslist figured out in the early 2000s about housing ads. And, you know, Facebook just kind of doesn't care when it comes to some of these things, right? As far as like the targeting goes, like advertisers do that kind of targeting anyway, right? Like demographic targeting is like advertiser 101. So even if they don't let you have a drop down that lets you select, you know, age, sex, race, you know, you could still triangulate your way into that, right? If you wanted to target a specific kind of person. That being said, the way that you know, in my neighborhood, the kinds of people who want to live here typically have families. They typically commute to work. You can twist that into it being a racial thing pretty easily, right? You could say, oh, this is, you know, they're targeting married people, right? They're targeting people with kids. Well, people with kids is actually a protected class, so you can't even target on that for housing ads.
There are two things here that make this idiotic complaint moot. One is, just because someone chooses to advertise to a particular group does not mean they would discriminate against the group they did not advertise to. It might just be that a certain group is more likely to buy from them than another group. For instance, as William said, there are Prince George's County in Maryland is the largest black, or sorry, the richest black majority county in the United States. And they're proud of that fact. And they want, you know, wealthier black people to move into this county. So they might pick ads that focus on targeting wealthier black people for housing ads. But that doesn't mean that if, you know, Whitey McMillaby came and knocked on the door and said, I'd like to live here, that they would say no. So just because you advertise doesn't mean you won't sell to. So that's one thing. And then two, I'll say this to Ben Carson, who's the HUD secretary. Guns don't kill people. Facebook ads do, apparently. My point being, there's a rule of law question here to me. Is Facebook discriminating against anyone in this context? No, it's the individual users using the platform in the same way that we don't go after gun manufacturers when people shoot people, because a gun is a product and Facebook is a product. And when it's used appropriately, nothing bad is going to happen. Justin might disagree with that in terms of Facebook. But the point being, it is the user who's doing the discriminating. So if you're going to go after someone for a stupid law that should be abolished in the first place, go after the people actually running the discriminatory ads. Yeah. But here's the thing, they're not going to do that because they're not going to be able to show actual harm.
Yeah, I think this illustrates the further point that you just hit, is that the law is a terrible law because it actually, the law includes or causes to be or allows to be, right? Like it's not just the person being held responsible, it's also the publisher being held responsible in this law. And this law needs to be repealed.
Well, or can we use this law to get rid of all social media?
Okay, Joker, burn it all down.
Justin doesn't see that as a Joker thing. Justin sees that as an unequivocal good for society. but the thing about it is there are, you know, there's recently a law passed, I forget the name of it, that makes it illegal for online platforms to host illegal content. But this is a really slippery slope, and I don't know. I honestly don't know if that's your standard where you draw the line. Are ISPs going to be responsible for websites that contain illegal content? Are, you know, server farms? Is Amazon server farm, what is it called, web services, going to be held responsible for content that's illegal on their servers?
I think the root DNS servers should be held responsible for allowing illegal content, for facilitating illegal content.
That's right.
I mean,
totally.
This has been done before, though. I mean, if you've read up on like the history of the incel movement, there's actually a link to pedophilia in it. And people have gone after the ISPs and the hosting sites because they would put up the ability to have message boards, and these people would create pro pedophilia message boards. And then they'll say these companies need to be attacked and banned because they're allowing these things to be hosted on their sites. And if the company came back and said, well, we believe in free speech, they'd say, well, this isn't free speech. This is fucked up. And obviously it's fucked up, but where's the line? Where's the line? And isn't this the point of net neutrality, to get in here and start regulating in that way? Because if you're regulating who you can serve to and what speeds, well, then you can also regulate what content people get, because then you can say certain content's discriminatory.
Now that you brought it up, I think we have to say where the line is, because I think we're uniquely suited to do that. Which the line is what? Force and fraud, just like it is literally everywhere else. So if there's a website about molesting children, that can clearly, I think, be taken down, or can be the owners can be, you know, prosecuted or whatever. And just like if there's a website advocating for rape or murder or anything else that's illegal, free speech ends where it initiates force or fraud. So I think that's a very clear line. But, you know, advertising based on certain demographics is nowhere near that line.
Well, unfortunately, I don't think we're going to see this law repealed anytime soon, this housing law repealed anytime soon. In fact, it might get much worse. I know we had a nice chat in Discord today. Make sure you join our Discord server. Link in the on themidside.com/podcast at the bottom of each episode. We talked about a story from MarketWatch about the eviction crisis is starting to look a lot like the subprime mortgage crisis, where there were such gems as the Georgia State authors come up with the effective premium that tenants pay through late fees is a systemic penalty that the lightly regulated market inflicts on those who are economically fragile. Anyways, so they want to pass a law because the lightly regulated rental market, and anyone who's been a landlord knows that that is just not true. And the whole idea that making a law to protect people who aren't paying for their rent from getting evicted, when it's already impossible to get back rent or people evicted in most states across the United States, is pretty hilarious. So I think
the average, I forget where I heard this, it might have been on a panel, so I might be misquoting, but it's something like, and I'll underplay, like the average is like, if you just move into a place and you just choose, I'm not paying rent from day one, like the quickest people can get you out is like 3 months in this country. But in many places, it's 6 months or 9 months or a year that you could just squat there not paying, essentially, because the rights are so in favor of tenants and not.
But it's a lightly regulated market. That's what
lightly regulated market. Well, speaking of light regulation and heavy regulation, Slate.com, who's certainly in favor of regulation, is trying to get in early on the woke Olympics with the Democratic candidates for 2020 by attacking one of the front runners. Indeed, the article is titled, "In a Diverse Candidate Field, How is Pete Buttigieg Sexuality Factoring into His Appeal?" Pete Buttigieg, for those of you who don't know, is the South Bend, Indiana mayor who is gay. He's 37 years old, and he entered the race basically with no name recognition whatsoever, but now in a new Emerson poll of Iowa voters, he is in third place behind only Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders. The poll puts Buttigieg in the same
class. What does that say about diversity, Daniel?
The poll puts Buttigieg in the same class as candidates who trailed him only a few points, including Senators Kamala Harris, Elizabeth Warren, and Cory Booker, all of whom, unlike Buttigieg, have held federal office and benefit from years of national press coverage. So the article is asking, essentially, in this field of women and black women and black men, and also Bernie Sanders, does Buttigieg's, his name is so fun to say, homosexuality actually count as diverse? That's the point the left is at now. He apparently doesn't identify his sexuality as being the driving force of his life. The article comments on this a little bit, saying a marginalized sexual orientation can remain unspoken and unnoticed for a long for as long as a queer person desires. A gay man who conforms to a critical mass of gendered expectations can move through life without his sexuality attending every interaction, even after he comes out. Buttigieg, for instance, would register on only the most finely tuned gaydar. Yes, this article literally said that. Most people are aware of his candidacy, probably know he's gay, but in his every appearance doesn't activate the, hey, that's that homosexual gentleman response in the average brain. That doesn't mean he's not gay enough. There's really no such measure. It just means that he might not be up against quite the same hurdles that a gay candidate without such sturdy ties to straight culture would be. So the article has many gems in it, and if you're curious, you should read them all. But it's essentially, it's making the argument that he's not oppressed enough to be the Democratic candidate. We need someone who's gone through more adversity because of some woke category of their being, or we need him to be more woke in his gayness. Otherwise, you know.
Wait. You need him to be more woke in his anus?
I said gayness. Otherwise, he's just a, quote, white male, upper class, Midwestern, married, Ivy League educated man of faith who happens to be gay.
I've got to stop us before we continue. This headline changed. The original headline was, is Pete, however you say his name, another white male candidate, or does his gayness count as diversity? That was the original headline.
That is a different headline.
Yeah. It's more accurate headline, I think.
Yes, for how the article is, certainly it is a more accurate headline, and his name... His campaign sells shirts that have the words boot, edge printed on them. So it's Buttigieg. You can also say Buttigieg, I learned. Anyway.
Yeah, but he's gay and his name really has butt in it?
It's boot, thank you. Spelled butt, but yes. Phonetically, it looks like Buttigieg, which is not correct. Buttigieg. Justin...
yeah, I'm here.
Basically speechless.
Well, I think that's the proper reaction to this article.
Nowhere in this story, do they discuss
any stance he has?
His ideas.
Yeah. Nowhere is like he's pro-abortion. He's anti-abortion. Like
I don't know what he believes. I only know he might not be gay enough for Slate.
Oh man, I mean, I think you are having the exact proper reaction to this article. I mean, you read this and you go like, oh my God, is this really the state that we're at in the year 2019? I mean, this is 2019. If I've ever heard 2019, like, I'm sure, look, we're both having, I think, the proper reactions. And I think this really hits home with William. I know William is the one who suggested it.
Yeah.
Because, William, you are a gay male who doesn't really ping the gaydar. You know, you're not, you like football.
I've been told I'm not gay enough a lot.
Yeah.
You are our Buttigieg.
Yeah. I think you have more to say about this, William. I think we are properly exasperated, so go ahead.
Yeah, I think that we've seen this story, gosh, for years now, right? A similar story where now that there's gay marriage, gay white men are no longer a participant in the oppression Olympics, right? It's sort of like we've erased all of history, right? If you're going to buy into the woke arguments and say that there were oppression in the past, people who are alive today actually lived in the past. But we're just pretending like none of that happened.
The more you know.
Yeah, it's crazy, right? We just pretend like that doesn't happen. But, you know, I don't buy into this whole oppression Olympics thing, so I'm cool with it. But when we look at, when we erase someone's, we talk about gay erasure, right? That's something that the social justice crowd likes to talk about. You erase gay people. This is exactly what they're talking about. This is exactly what they're talking about when they don't take someone individually seriously because they're not gay enough. What they're doing the same, they're flipping the coin over and doing the same thing. They're erasing this person as an individual with individual ideas and a candidate with actual stances on things, and having a debate about is he gay enough and does the way he acts, is that gay enough? Does it represent a history of oppression enough that allows him to be elected? It's so devastating, right? I don't, this is a part of a bigger conversation that I know we've, Justin and I have had about, like, I'm gay, but don't identify as gay. That's part of the joke of the opening for me. And it's because I don't live a life where that part of me, that part of my identity is so fundamental that it has to be in every single conversation I have, right? I am not the gay computer security guy. I'm a pretty good computer security guy, right? I'm not the gay person who plays French horn. I'm a guy who plays French horn, right? Like, these are not, these are not, it's
however,
yeah,
you are the gay third host of the Midside.
I'm the woman on the podcast as we open with.
Whatever. I don't listen to the show.
I don't know. I'm interested in your guys' take. I appreciate that, Daniel, that you noticed right away they didn't talk about his ideas, which to me proves that point of erasure, right? Like, if you don't fit into the stereotype in social justice land, you are erased. And I see this all the time. I try to engage with people, especially on topics like diversity and inclusion. And unless I identify as gay, I don't even get to have those discussions. And if I don't, if I don't identify properly, right? Like, if I don't hold the right views, I'm immediately seen in the worst possible light, right? Like, anything I say is immediately taken, is immediately strawmanned or taken into a direction, into some sort of weird direction, right? And it's impossible to have any nuanced positions when you can either be, you are either gay in the sense of social justice, or you are other. And it's very, very frustrating and farcical.
Justin, how do you think the left would ideally choose their president? Because it's clearly not on ideas. Do you think they would just line them up on a stage and have them talk about all the hardships they've gone through because of their various oppressive identities? Or, like, how would they legitimately choose between Liz Warren, Kamala Harris, Cory Booker, and Pete Buttigieg?
I mean, do you want me to write a satire sketch right now, or do you want me to, like, have real talk?
There's kind of a joke in there, but I'm also kind of serious. If ideas are out the window, if we don't really care as long as they meet a threshold of woke, right, i.e. they have a Democrat logo on the back of their name, how do you actually make this choice? Is there some standard?
This is where I disagree. Let me jump in real fast. It's because they cannot differentiate themselves on ideas, because this is a dogma, that they can only differentiate themselves on virtue signaling. This is the same as when I was growing up in a backwards-ass Southern Baptist church. It's not that you can have a debate or differentiate yourself on different ideas because you must conform. What you must do is show that you are more virtuous. And in social justice land, that's by being more of a victim.
I am shaking my head so hard right now. All of that is just marketing to the people, to us little dumb fucks who have no idea what's going on because we're too ignorant to know what's going on behind the curtain. And I'm using that facetiously because they're picking, and they will ultimately pick their candidate by who best fits and who can get them the most control. That is all it's about. They thought it would be Hillary because of all of the history that Hillary had, and they thought it was time for a female candidate, and that's why they picked Hillary, and that's why they hate Trump so much. That is why Trump derangement syndrome has become a thing.
And it's why they deed over Bernie Sanders.
Right. 100%. That's why they deed over Bernie Sanders, because you know what? They had a chance to beat Trump with Bernie Sanders if they were actually concerned about getting the office and getting what the people wanted. There were a lot of people who equated Trump and Bernie Sanders, where people would say, I would take Trump or Bernie Sanders. That shows how people don't understand ideas, is what you're saying. But this is all 100% on both sides of the aisle. They want to pick the candidate that's the most electable simply so they can get power. And not just most electable, they want to convince us that the candidate's electable who will help them forward their agenda that they're not really telling us what their agenda is. The wokeness is all just marketing nowadays. That's it.
Interesting. Woke as targeting. But what are they going to do when they can't target ethnicities on Facebook anymore? Anyway, stupid joke. So on to the final story, which I don't want to spend a ton of time on because it's wildly but it is one of the most shocking stories ever. A Chandler, Arizona police force broke through the door of a family's home in the middle of the night, stormed in, pointed their guns, handcuffed the father, and watched as the state's Department of Child Safety took custody of the parents' three kids. Why? Because the mom decided her toddler's fever was not serious enough to merit a trip to the hospital. So the background of this is a woman takes her two-year-old to the doctor with a fever. She's pregnant, has three kids already. Fever's over 100. Goes to the doctor. The doctor says, hey, you should go to the hospital. And to be fair to him, he thinks that it's because maybe the kid is unvaccinated. Perhaps he has meningitis or some life-threatening disease. Fine. But as the mother is leaving the doctor's office, the kid is happy and jumping around and playing, and by the time they get home, the fever is already down. And so the hospital tells the doctor the kid never came. The doctor calls and says, hey, mom, take the kid to the hospital because I said so. Mom says, yeah. So eventually the doctor reports this to Child Protective Services, and without going through proper procedures, Child Protective Services decides, you know, this could be a life-threatening situation for this child, so they're going to militarily SWAT team-esque bust down the door, take the three kids, put them in foster homes, by the way, and while this is all going through, and then tries to get the judge to bar media from the courtroom, and basically acts in the most absurd, obscene possible measure if you actually think parents have any legitimate say in what their child does, how their child is raised. Justin, this is an egregious abuse of power, but it shows you the extent to which the state thinks it can do whatever it wants in our lives, including, by the way, taking a village to raise a child.
Yeah, and to drive home that point, and it's what we were just talking about with the whole, or I was just ranting about with the whole secret agenda or agenda they're not really telling you. Even you glossed over what I think is the flashpoint of this story. I think this entirely has to do with this whole vaccination issue, where what other rationalization could the doctor have, and could the Child Protective Services have, by saying, oh, well, look, this is a mother that doesn't even vaccinate her children, so clearly she's endangering them. Oh, we have to take them because she's so irrational. Where, and I'm going to probably sound like a conspiracy theorist now, but where government-mandated vaccinations are one of the biggest ways government can control us. Daniel and William? I mean, look, I agree there are certain things that for the health and welfare of the country that should be mandated vaccination, right? When we're talking about something like smallpox or measles, these are things that need to be eradicated and people need to have vaccinations for. But I don't have a kid. Midsider Katrina has a kid, and she's told me about some of the vaccinations that are required and things. And I think there's a legitimate discussion to be had here as far as where are the lines as to what vaccinations should be government mandated and not, or not. But this story is an example of literally using force to mandate or to ensure compliance with government overreach.
Yeah, it's totally nuts. And what blows me away about all these stories, and this happens more often than you think, what blows me away about all these stories is that the government is never acting in good faith, meaning, you know, sending kids to foster homes. You know, this could have been sorted out in a 21-minute phone call or an hour-long sit-down with the parents, but no, Child Protective Services ordered a SWAT team in to bust down the doors and point guns at people. Because they're not acting in good faith. They're not actually interested in the welfare of the child. They're interested in their own power.
Right. They're trying to scare them into getting the vaccination. And they're trying to scare everyone else who knows them into getting the vaccinations. It is a fear tactic.
Yeah, I don't know if the vaccination plays as big a role in this as you're suggesting. So I don't want to go that far.
I think the angle I was looking at was more of this overuse of SWAT teams for something, and I think that ties into Justin what you were saying about and Daniel about the just complete disregard for the context of the situation. Do you need a SWAT team to go in, knock on the door, and see if the kid still has a fever? Right? Like, if the kid...
Right.
Like a legitimate thing might be, like, hey, this if a doctor tells you this kid has a fever, he should go to the hospital, and then the person leaves, I think it's legitimate that the doctor's concerned. Maybe CPS should be notified, right? But the second step, where CPS calls in the SWAT team, that's the part that is completely disconnected from reality. I mean, we just had the guy that swatted and got that guy killed, swatted that gamer, and then they went to the wrong house and killed someone. He just got 20 years. So maybe that CPS officer should get 20 years. This is amazingly stupid.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing here. Whether you think it's about the vaccinations or not, it is totally about the overreach of government force in order to get people to be fearful of the government. But I have another question, or sort of a point, based upon what you were just saying, William. Is the child might have a fever enough reason for the government to go into somebody's house? And what I mean by that is, this is one of the harshest things that you, the harshest realities to accept, and, you know, wake the fuck up, right? To quote Zack Snyder about with freedom. Is there is going to be a certain amount of death and tragedy due to stupidity and ignorance. And maybe this kid would have died. But is it really the government's job to go into every household and protect against stupidity and ignorance of the parents, of the siblings, of the extended family? Again, where is the line of the government going to people's houses and protecting them from things?
Yeah, so I think the first step there... Well, the first step there, I think, is legitimate. Like, if someone is going against doctor's advice that, like, severely, I don't know if fever is the right line. Like, I'm not saying that. But if someone's going against a doctor, if someone comes into the doctor's office and they clearly have a broken bone and the parents refuse to take them to the hospital to get it set, maybe you can say, hey, this should be reported. And then if that's part of a pattern of behavior that CPS knows about child abuse, then that becomes a legitimate thing, right? The second step is the one I'm focusing on, right? Where CPS calls the SWAT team. That's the step that's completely inappropriate, right? Like, the CPS saying, we're going to make a note. This parent, you know, refused the doctor's advice. Might not be a big deal, but we'll keep it and see if it's part of a pattern. The part where you call the SWAT team, that's the part that is fucked up.
Yeah. Because I think the difficulty here, Justin, and I'm sympathetic, but the difficulty here is that, you know, children are not parents' property, right? They can't do with them anything that they want. They are a guardian because this child has rights. Those rights are held in guardianship until they can actualize those rights for themselves. And so if those rights are being violated, there is a legitimate state interest to make sure that those rights not be violated any longer. So maybe in this instance, especially, we don't know the exact situation, but let's say the child came in and he was lethargic and passing out and the fever looked horrible and whatever. And so the doctor wants him to go to the hospital and then he leaves and he's fine. I don't really have a problem with protective services just calling them up and saying, hey, we're just checking to make sure, you know, everything's okay. You didn't go to the hospital. Like, is it a matter of you can't afford it? Or is it a matter of, like, your car broke down, or did the fever get better? And that's really all you need, right? You don't need guys with guns drawn busting down a door at midnight and handcuffing people. You just need, some friendliness. And I know there are going to be some libertarians who say I'm being wildly, wildly too nice to the state, and that can never happen because the state is force. But, you know, if we're going to shoot for an ideal, I think that is the ideal. How it happens in reality, I'm not sure, but that's the ideal to me.
Right. I mean, and that's what you're really talking about is, and the ideal would be, in a rational world, you'd be able to have conversations with people and actually figure out what's going on. Now the problem becomes, in reality, not everyone rational even in a idealized world. So where do you, you know, draw that line? Because to me, it's like, if it's that bad that you had to send in a SWAT team, why don't you have police officers at the doctor's office or hospital where you don't let people leave? Why would you, if the fever was that bad, why would you even let the kid leave if we're going to start using force? Do you understand my argument?
Yeah. And so I think the doctor was maybe a little too overreactive here, but it's really Child Protective Services who went from step B to steps F and U very quickly.
I see what you did there.
And that was ridiculous. So I'll say one thing about vaccinations, Justin, because I don't want this to go unsaid. I'm pretty much like 98% pro vaccination. I do understand the right of parents to evaluate the vaccinations their child gets, and I certainly did that. And I don't say this for the opposing side, not that there is a strong opposing side, but what I'll say is when the doctor first handed me the list of all the vaccinations that were recommended for my son in his first year of life, it was something like 42 shots.
So, and you're going to have to stab your son with a needle 42 times to protect him.
And I did think, like, this seems excessive. And some of them are for, like, HPV, for instance. You know, that was literally the first vaccine they wanted to give him was an HPV vaccine. And I get it. You should be vaccinated against that. But he's 3 days old. Does he need to be, you know, how many chicks is he banging at 3 days old?
He's starting young, huh? How dare you assume his sexuality, by the way?
Right. So, look, I worked with my doctor and I said, I want to get all the major vaccinations. I want to get even the ones that are somewhat minor vaccinations, but I'd like to come up with a different schedule for this so that we're not loading all these. And he said, well, one of the reasons is that, you know, like the measles, mump, rubella, whatever it is, vaccine, I'm probably messing those things up because I'm not a doctor. He says they used to give it like in two shots. And now they give it in like six shots or something like that. So it's taking the same vaccine and giving to them in smaller doses over time. They think it's more effective that way. So that counts for some of the number of shots. But some of the things he said, yeah, it's totally fine. We can wait until he's, you know, a year and a half or two for some of these. That's not a problem. And the doctor worked with me on it. So there's a conversation to be had here.
Let me get this straight. No SWAT team came to your door?
Not yet. No SWAT team busted down my door because my dog would sick him, man. He is a ferocious Yorkie. So my point is there's a conversation to be had here, even with your doctor, and we don't have to all just shout at each other over the internet.
First of all, blasphemy. We don't have to shout at each other across the internet. How you dare is an American life.
What else do you do with the internet? Other than the
second
audience.
Of all, Just the idea of stabbing a child 42 times in his first year of life, like that just seems very traumatic to me. It just seems like we're giving these kids trauma.
I mean, potentially, I don't disagree with you in the sense that, like, for instance, the severity of circumcision has been linked to trauma later on in life. And so, you know, we didn't circumcise our son for that reason. And also because we think it's totally, there's no reason to do it. But you know, it's not, some of them are traumatic. Like Isaac has cried on some shots and some he's just looked at me like, where are we going after this? Like, so it, in some cases it is traumatic. Mostly depends on his mood, I guess, or I don't know, maybe they feel different. I'm not sure. But some of them, he couldn't care less. You're just playing with his stuffed owl called Archimedes. That's what we only have difficult names in this house between our dog Xerxes and the owl Archimedes. And he's fine. So yes, no, maybe it's all, talk to your doctor. That's what I'm saying. And have a doctor you trust to talk to, by the way. Don't just pick some random doctor.
Well, that's another problem with the system, but that's another discussion for another time. I think that's a great way to end the new week. William, do you have anything else to follow up with?
Nope. I think we hit all the important points. I'm just glad now that I finally have privilege after all these years.
Well, I think we're going to have to maybe put a hold on that privilege. I don't know. We'll talk about that. There's a lot to say in regards to diversity and privilege when we're talking about movies in The Hopeful Romantic with JML. Put me into syndication, broadcast to a network station of people viewing their favorite episodes. I can't find a new pitch to throw the studio. I need I was going to start with a plug for Discord here, but William already did that. I would just like to underline the fact that it really helps us. I mean, first of all, it helps me because it makes it easier to produce the show when you guys are all submitting content out there. But it helps us reach out to you and establish a relationship. I mean, the second story, the Facebook discriminatory housing advertising practices, that was submitted by Midsider Frank. Midsider Megan, I believe, has submitted the Chernobyl trailer we're going to talk about. So I appreciate that. So yeah, do what William said and go look for the link on the midside.com/podcast and join our Discord. So William, Daniel, I did what I didn't think I was going to do, and I saw the movie Us.
Oh, man. Have you converted?
I have not converted, but what I'm interested in is, what have you all been hearing? You two, what have you been hearing?
Well, I heard from some reviewers who gave a 9 out of 10 to Get Out that this was a 4 out of 10.
Interesting.
Interesting. I mean, mostly from my non-political friends on Facebook, I heard it was like one of the best horror movies ever. So, but, you know, and I think we're going to get into this. The director made some comments this week that made me leery of watching it, and also Get Out. You know, I'm not interested in woke anything. So,
yeah, and that's the interesting thing about this movie. William, why are they saying it's worse than Get Out? I would say I was more entertained than Get Out. Why are they saying it's worse than Get Out?
Well, I think the particular reviewer I'm thinking of was able to kind of see past the social justice undertones and just see Get Out as a good horror suspense movie. But I think for some reason that wasn't possible with Us. I'd be interested in your review.
Okay. Oh, I did hear that it was anti-socialism. I don't know if you want to get into that.
No. That's a complete misreading of the twist at the end of the movie, which I saw 10 minutes into it. No. It is not anti-socialism. It's pro-socialism.
No, okay.
No. Whoever said that didn't understand the twist at the end of the movie.
That was a Drudge link.
Yeah, well, Drudge was wrong. He didn't understand the movie. Okay, so it's interesting, William, what you're saying, because it's causing me to go over a few things in my head. The first thing is Get Out was not entertaining at all, okay? When we'll get to the whole absurdity of the end of the movie, but it was not entertaining at all. It was very slow at the beginning, and there was nothing compelling about it. It was just not interesting. It was just very not interesting at all. And this movie suffered from a lot of the same things at the beginning, where it was very slow in the beginning. It wasn't as bad as Get Out, but you could see Peele is learning how to pace things a little bit better. But there was a whole opening set in the year 1986. Then it flashes forward to present day. And then you're just spending a lot of time naturalistically getting to know this family. Now, it's not too naturalistic. Like, the reason I was able to pick out the twist is there were some lines and things were shown for a reason. But it's just Peele literally does not know how to pace things directorially and writing-wise to be able to have it not be this sort of slow meandering. You can tell he's trying to rise above the whole naturalistic style, but he's being stuck into it. And again, I'm not talking about the ideas of this movie right now. I'm talking about purely from a technical standpoint. The greatest problem with this movie is, and I think this is, William, why whatever you were seeing was saying this is better than Get Out, much more than Get Out. This movie was built around one scene at the end. And you can tell everything was just to get to that scene. And that was the scene he had in his head. And then everything else was to get out of that scene. So it wasn't like with Get Out, everything was built towards that final moment where they're in the streets and the words Get Out come up on the screen. So it was building to that final punch at the end. This was
Building so you meant the other way around, right? Because you said Us was better. I was saying that the reviewer I was looking at said Get Out was better than Us.
No. I'm explaining why they're saying that. I enjoyed Us more than Get Out. To me, Get Out was boring all the way through. I was just bored by that movie. Us was not as technically well done that this person is talking about, because it meandered for long times because it was building towards one moment near the end. Whereas the punch, although there was a punch, the twist was revealed at the very end of this movie. The punch at the end of Get Out was the very last moment. So it was if you were involved, invested in Get Out, it would keep you gripped until the end. Whereas with Us, there's the moment that you're the grip is let go of and you feel safe, and then it hits you with another twist. So that's why it would feel I'm arguing it's a feeling thing. Get Out would feel better than Us if you're looking to be tense and horrified the entire movie. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, that would be what someone might want to get out of a horror suspense movie.
Right. Now here's the thing about this whole thing. William, get ready with the whole soundboard here. I'm going to do spoilers, okay? Because I don't think anyone's going to see this.
There's walkers in the barn and Lori's pregnant.
Right, Daniel, William, you don't intend on seeing this?
Nope.
Never.
Okay. So the fact that the stars of Black family is interesting because what happens is this family goes to vacation at Santa Cruz. This is a well-off, a wealthy, well-achieved Black family. And they go there they rent a summer house, and they're spending time with a white family as well. And all of a sudden, one night, doubles show up at their house of them. And these doubles start trying to kill them. They're able to kill a couple of the doubles. And then they go to the white friend's house, and the white friends have all been killed by their doubles as well, and they kill the white friend's doubles. So these doubles are not just Black. Like, I thought this was going to be some kind of commentary on the Black community, and this is where all of the ideas behind it get very confused, because it's like, why did you introduce this idea that this is actually a world epidemic? So doubles of everyone start showing up in the entire world and trying to kill the people that have been living above ground. So basically there's a series of tunnels underneath the entire United States where all of these doubles have been living. If you have a double, Daniel, and he's been living there your entire life, and they finally decided to come to the surface. Now, this is where the twist at the end of the movie comes in. So I'm going to foreshadow the twist, and then I'm going to explain the twist after I explain the big moment, just to give you a sort of similar experience to what the movie was. So the movie starts in the year 1986, where the main character, the younger version of her, so she's played by Lupita, I don't know how to say her last name. Phenomenal performance, by the way. If you want to know why this movie works, it's because Lupita is tremendous and Elizabeth Moss are tremendous. Otherwise, this movie is just sort of like a bad sketch. But so it starts as her as a kid. And she's at the fair, or she's at the boardwalk in Santa Cruz with her parents. And her mom goes to the bathroom, and then her dad is playing a game and lets her wander off. He's not paying attention to her, which is another subtext of this movie that was very strange to me. They really make the Black male fathers look terrible. They're just incompetent. They're uncaring. They're goofy. It's just, there's a lot to reflect there on, but I don't even know if that was intentional, but. So she wanders off and she goes into like one of those House of Mirror things, and she literally sees her double. And then it, you know, flashes forward to a scene where she's at the doctor and her parents are talking to the doctor about how she hasn't been able to talk since she came back from the House of Mirrors. And the doctor's like, well, it's trauma, and she's gone through stress, and she's suffering trauma. And then the mother says, I just want my daughter back. So then you flash forward to the end of the movie where the main character, Lupita, goes underground and she confronts her double. And her double explains to her that, you know, we are the shadow people. We are tethered together. At one point, they don't explain who they is, but assuming it's the government, figured out how to clone people, basically, but couldn't clone the soul. So there were two people sharing one soul, and they had to leave the tethered, the shadow people, underground. And because of Lupita's double, they were able to rise up, and this is their rebellion against the surface people, basically. So you have this weird commentary on the haves and the have-nots. You have this weird commentary on the upper mobility of Black people, because the reason they're experiencing this is because they're the ones who have, and they're ignoring where they come from. You have this weird commentary on like the descendants of slavery, forgetting your past, just burying it underground. It's almost like the Underground Railroad down there. So there's just a lot of weird things going on. Now, before I go into my commentary, I want to say that, do you remember when Get Out came out? It had a 99% on Rotten Tomatoes, and there was one person who had the balls enough to write out against Get Out and say it was bad.
And it wasn't you?
Well, besides me, but they don't count me on Rotten Tomatoes.
Yeah.
No, it was Armand White for the National Review. Now, I want to be clear, his last name is White, but he is a very black man if you look at his picture. And I want everyone to go and read his review of this movie, because it is 100% perfect. I mean, it culminates with him calling Jordan Peele a charlatan, saying he's making no real commentary. This is all just a ruse to get popular and get notoriety based upon taking advantage of this whole wokeness and woke generation in order to appear like he has something to say. And that's exactly what these movies are. I mean, it is mind-boggling to me that anyone takes these things seriously. Get Out was this whole thing about white appropriation of black culture. And then it culminates with you're taking the brains out of black bodies and putting white brains into them. That is a fucking cockamamie insane premise. We sit there and we watch that and we go, that's reasonable. And then this one, so she goes underground and she finds out about all of this cloning and all this bullshit. And then what happens is when she learned to dance when she was a kid, the clone was dancing too. And there was this whole scene where you can tell this was the scene in Jordan Peele's mind that he was culminating in, where that song from the trailer, You Got Five on It, is playing as there's the exposition dump of what's going on. Oh, no, sorry, it's not exposition dump. They're fighting. The two Lupitas are fighting while it's intercut with the song and also intercut with her dancing as a kid and the clone dancing as a kid. I know that's the visual he had in his head, and I appreciate that from an artistry standpoint, that here's a guy with a vision and he's executing it. It's just really tough to not be like, this vision is terrible. So then there's the final twist. Now I want to ask you, because I seeded it in there, based upon how I described the flashback in 1986, can you guess what the twist of the movie was at the very end?
I have to admit, I'm not really listening to you. So
that, okay. She's the double.
I'm just kidding.
She's the double, correct.
Yeah.
It was very obvious that they switched at the beginning. And that's why the whole point is the people on the surface are evil. Because she has been the whole point at the end is that she's the double who switched when they were kids. And that's what allowed this whole thing to happen. And she took over the life of the wealthy surface dweller. So she herself could be happy when she knew all those shadow people were suffering underneath. That is the commentary of the movie. The point is, the people on the surface are the villains. And that's supposed to be the punch in the social commentary at the end.
It's very surface level.
Very good. I think that is the best way of reviewing this movie. The best way of reviewing Jordan Peele. Read the Armand White article. He is a charlatan. This is all a fucking scam. I will say this about my experience in the theater. I went into this having seen Get Out and having a certain level of expectation. And I go, okay, I'm going to see if he's actually improved or if this is the same level of sort of farce. So I went in with that expectation. And when it became very obvious that it was farce, what do you think I openly started doing in the theater?
Laughing.
I was 100% laughing at things that were terrible or things that were funny that were meant to be scary. And you want to know what happened afterwards? People started laughing with me because they weren't afraid to laugh anymore. Because people are going in there and they're appreciating this and they're saying it's good because they feel social pressure to. But because I wasn't afraid and I started laughing, other people started laughing. And it was the people closest to me who were laughing as well because I made that okay. Now, there are certain elements of comedy in here where Peele is letting more of his comedic side out. But I was definitely laughing at things that were not intended to be funny, but they were funny because of how absurd they were. And I made that okay for everyone else. And that's what we need to start doing. This is witnessing the farce. My experience with this movie was I literally witnessed the farce. So I'm going to take the stunned silence as that was a good review there. So I probably won't ever see another Jordan Peele movie. And it's not for the next thing we're going to talk about, but I think the next thing creates an interesting discussion. I'm trying to pull up the quote here, so I'm stalling a little bit. Forward to the quote. Okay, I found the quote. So there was some controversy this week about what Jordan Peele said about the way he casts movies. Because again, this movie could have been done totally as a non-racial premise of there are doubles underground, but he decided to make it about a black family. So he said, "I don't see myself casting a white dude as the lead in my movie. Not that I don't like white dudes, but I've seen that movie. It really is one of the best, greatest pieces of this story, is feeling like we are in this time, a renaissance has happened, and prove the myths about representation in the industry are false." So there's been cries that this is reverse racism, or it's just simply racism on his part. Now I'm going to get your guys' take in a second, but there's two things here. One, good for him. If he wants to cast whoever he wants in his movie, it's his movie. If he wants to do whatever he wants in his movie, it's his movie. I applaud him for doing what he wants to do if he is honestly trying to make a piece of art. I'm not convinced. I think Armand White makes a very good point that it's all just second-handed, just performance art for attention, performance art for accolades. Remember, this guy has won an Academy Award for this crap. Right, so I'm not convinced that it's truly for art, but if that's what he's doing, let him do it. It's whatever he wants to do with his art. Even if he's doing it for second-handed reasons, it's his art. Let him do what he wants to do.
As long as he doesn't put casting calls on Facebook.
Right, as long as he doesn't put casting calls on Facebook, right, because that would be discriminatory. That is the line. That is the line. But here's my main problem with what he said. Why does he have to frame it as "I won't cast white dudes"? Why can't he frame it as "I prefer to cast black people"? Why do you have to say it in the negative? That's where it becomes, it seems like, I'm not saying it becomes racism, but it becomes a discussion of is this racism? And where it starts to feel like reverse racism, because he's not saying "I prefer to cast black people," which you're like, oh, okay, whatever. You know, it's just like "I prefer to cast all women." Oh, okay, whatever. That's fine. But when you start saying "I won't cast a white dude as my lead," that's when it starts to feel racist. And that's the problem. I feel like this is a problem. I think this is a problem more of phrasing than it is a problem of
very generous
ideas. Well, and that's the question I want to ask you guys. Is this a case where phrasing is revealing of his underlying biases?
Yeah. Because the discussion isn't about race. There's no, I mean, race is just framing it in terms of race is silly. It's woke. It's social justice. It's nonsense. You know, how about I'll cast people who help me tell the story the best way I want to tell it? Then leave it at that. And if you cast a bunch of black people or a bunch of Asians or a bunch of white people, who cares? If you're making the estimate that these are the people who can help best tell the story I want to tell. But because he frames it as a racial issue, that is telling of his mentality. And it's telling of the mentality of the left, who are racists, who are the modern day racists, and maybe the old racists as well, by the way, if you look at the history. But
I think that there were not enough black people in Crazy Rich Asians. I think that really whenever you have a director that will say that they're, this is clearly pandering, this quote is pandering. Whenever you have a director that will use pandering rather than stand up for story, right? For story and theme. Like, I'm going to pick the characters and cast them based on the story and theme that I'm trying to portray. Then I have no respect for you as a director.
Well, exactly. So let's exactly contrast this with what Snyder's been raked over the coals for in the past week. He's completely about the story. That quote that we talked about at the top of this episode, wasn't that completely about story?
Yeah, he's not woke enough. He's not looking at it in this woke lens where Jordan Peele is.
Right, and one is pandering and one isn't. So I think maybe that is the best way. Maybe we can come to a consensus here in this quorum. Is that the best way to describe Jordan Peele, that he makes pandering movies?
I think so.
He's two for two. It's not a pattern, but it's close.
He's 2 for 2 in this. Like, I just don't know how anyone can sit there. Like, and I'm someone who likes, you know, Lady in the Water, which is like this absurd fantastical thing, right? I like these fantastical movies and these fantastical premises. But Daniel, the description of, like, I'm surprised you didn't react, so I can tell you weren't listening to me. Like, the description of the underground world where we keep our clones and the government built a series of tunnels for these clones to live in. I mean, isn't that just fucking outright absurd, like, for the movie?
Look, I don't know how it was all set up. His premises, his conclusions, his everything to me just seems totally uninteresting. So,
and that's the thing. Like, they're uninteresting because he doesn't integrate it throughout. If that was really your premise, you didn't integrate that premise throughout the movie at all. It just they feel like reveals that come out of nowhere, which actually leads into Trailer Takedown very well. And as you know, the trailers for Trailer Takedown are usually posted on the website on Saturday mornings. So you can go there and you can look at them either, you know, before the show, during the show. You can pause the show and, you know, watch them during the show.
Trailer Takedown. First trailer.
We finally got a long trailer for the Twilight Zone reboot, which is also done by Jordan Peele. And as what I just said is, I think the biggest concern here is the twists in his movies are these premises in Get Out and Us are so absurd and so outside the realm of the world he creates. So he creates a world and then he creates a premise for that world, a situation for that world that almost doesn't fit with the world he's shown up until that point. Now, the Twilight Zone is exactly the opposite of that. What made Rod Serling's show so good is when you get to the reveals, when you get to whatever the big twist is, the big moment is, it works perfectly for everything that came before. It fits in that world. The world was constructed around that in a logical way. So the trailer here, it looks well produced. The casting is great. There's a lot of known people who are good actors. But I have a major concern here with the fact that it's Jordan Peele heading this. I wonder how involved he is with the creative and how involved he is with writing all of this. And that, it makes me very concerned after having now seen Us about what's going to happen here. Also, the fact that this is only on CBS All Access, I am not going to go out of my way to watch this. The Twilight Zone is one of the greatest properties in American history, one of the greatest things to come out of American entertainment. And I am very worried about what's going to be done to it. I imagine William feels much the same way because of what they did to Star Trek with Star Trek Discovery. So unless proven otherwise, I am only going to watch this long down the road out of curiosity. So unless proven otherwise, this is a tackle.
Tackle.
Go ahead, Daniel.
Jordan Peele, tackle.
Tackle.
Justin, you totally summarized my view immediately. After what they've done to Star Trek Discovery, there is no way in hell I'm subscribing or giving any money to, in any way, CBS. So, tackle.
Tackle. Second trailer.
The Silence is a Netflix movie that's another version of A Quiet Place or Bird Box. In this, they actually show the monster. It stars Stanley Tucci and Kieran Shipka, who you may know from Mad Men. And they're a family who, they're in a world where if they make noise, these like bat pterodactyl characters come down and kill them. Now, I still haven't seen A Quiet Place. I'm starting to think I need to because of the way this whole new, like, I mean, even in Us, right? We're having all these world crises that families are having to learn how to deal with and survive in. So there's a very interesting tension here where something I talk about on the show is we're living in a more globalized world, but now all these movies are about how the families are trying to survive in these globalized conflicts. Although in this conflict, in this crisis, I think it was only affecting cities on the Eastern Seaboard, which could have interesting commentary to it. What I did like about this trailer was it looked very stylized, which I appreciated. With A Quiet Place, the production value looked very slick and high quality, but here it looked like they were going for more stylization. So I actually, even though this trailer had less of a mystery element to it, like the hook of A Quiet Place was like, ooh, what are the monsters? This had less of a mystery element to it, but this was more appealing to me than A Quiet Place because it looked like I was seeing what was going on with the artistry here. So this is a tentative hug.
Hug.
Daniel?
No. I'm just tired of this premise already. Why do we have to be quiet everywhere? It's because quiet is scary, I guess. What if here was a movie where unless you were screaming, a bat attacked you? Wouldn't that be more horrifying? You get to scream constantly. It's like Speed, but for your voice. This didn't look compelling to me at all. I'm uninterested, and Netflix continues to produce weird crap. Tackle.
Tackle.
It's an interesting point, Daniel. I think it reveals something about our culture that what's scary to us is a world where we can't speak to each other.
Yeah, I'm fine with that, though.
I was so bored watching this one. I really don't have a lot to say, so I'm going to tackle it.
Tackle. Third trailer.
Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark is based on a children's book. And in that children's book, there are stories that this woman wrote or is writing, or I don't know, and things happen. And I think it's a children's book. I didn't understand most of this trailer. There was just two things, right? The first thing is, I get the impression that this is supposed to be a kid's movie, but it looks like it's too graphic for kids or the tone is off for kids. So that seems very strange to me. And then there was just one line in this trailer that just fucking killed me. Because they did a pause in the middle of it, and I go, don't do it. Don't do it. Don't do it.
Is it the, can I guess?
Yes.
Is it the book reads you?
Yes. Line? We're not reading the book. The book is reading, or you're not reading the book. The book is reading you. In the middle of that line, it was, you're not reading the book. I go, don't fucking do it. Don't fucking do it. The book is reading you. And I go, I'm out. I'm out. That's terrible. That is terrible. I don't understand this at all. I don't understand the hype. Tackle.
Tackle?
I wouldn't say I was angry or constipated, but okay.
Yeah, between this and Goosebumps and wasn't there something else as a child? There's another scary book like this.
I mean, there wasn't a book, but there was Are You Afraid of the Dark or Nickelodeon.
Yeah, I read a lot of this as a kid, and I think it's supposed to be like a preteen thing, so maybe a little scarier than like a Goosebumps type of book. Nonetheless, terrible acting. I don't care. Not for me. And from CBS Films, tackle.
Tackle.
I think this movie wants to be the Cruel Intentions of horror movies, but it's clearly not going to be. So I'm going to tackle.
Tackle. Final trailer.
Chernobyl is an HBO miniseries based upon the events of Chernobyl. I can't tell if they're trying to show what really happened. They're trying to be naturalistic. There's a lot that's up in the air about this show. The acting looked good. I mean, it's one of the guys from Mad Men. He was in it, the guy with the glasses. I don't know the actor's name, but he was very good in it. I mean, the production value looks very high. My concern about this is it would just be, you know, I don't know how many episodes the miniseries it is, but we'll say 5 to 10. It'd just be 5 to 10, 8 episodes of just like, oh, look at these people suffering because of this horrific thing that happened. Now, it could potentially be about, you know, why it happened and how it happened and, you know, demonstrating the tragedy of that, and there can be a valid story to tell there. There's just not enough in the trailer here to give me any indication if I'm going to want to sit through, you know, 5 to 10 hours of this. So unless proven otherwise, and I think Daniel may prove me otherwise because it seems like something he may like, unless proven otherwise, this is a tentative tackle.
Tackle.
Yeah, this is right in my wheelhouse for genres. It's sort of political and miniseries. And I probably will see this at some point. The thing that makes me hesitant is not the story, but the way they're approaching the story. And I'm not sure if we need yet something else in our culture that talks about how awful nuclear is in general. Because it is statistically, and this is not debatable, it is statistically the safest form of energy that exists. And yet all we get are movies like Chernobyl, and that's all we talk about is Chernobyl, 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 when windmills and solar panels kill more people ever than nuclear. So it is a very, very tentative hug.
Hug?
Yeah, Daniel, I completely agree. I worry about what this movie, like, it's hard not to question the motives of a movie like this. But at the same time, this seems interesting to me. So I'm kind of in the same boat. This is something that I'd be interested in seeing, at least the first one. So I'm going to give it a tentative hug as well.
Hug?
Well, it's very interesting the way you guys just discussed that, because I think that leads into...
Oh, wait, didn't you trigger the rule? Come on now.
You trigger the rule. Pick one.
No, I said tentatively hug the silence.
Oh, okay.
Oh.
Who's going to watch the silence? I got to listen to you more.
Fine.
I did it. I said tentatively hug. Thanks for listening. I appreciate the fact that you're paying attention to everything on the show. And I had a good transition that I was loading up and you just derailed it.
That's what we're here for. That's why you have co-hosts.
So I think you guys raised an interesting discussion right at the end here. And I think that transitions very well into Life on the Midside. Take a good look around. This life really sucks. Are we just complaining? I hope that this mic is on. Because I'm on a roll here. I hope this is making some sense. I hope that you throw up your hands and sing it and tell all the haters that they should just shut up and smile. Yeah. So something you guys talked about with Chernobyl is being worried about what the agenda of that movie was. Where its perspective is coming from. And that I think that's an interesting discussion to have, because we come from a more objectivist perspective on this show. And one of the things about objectivism is not sanctioning things that are morally bad and things that are destructive. And we see with a lot of objectivists, or at least I see, let me speak for myself, I see with a lot of objectivists them going too far with it. So I think there's an interesting discussion to have about where is the line? And I think this discussion works very well as well because of talking about Jordan Peele today and how absurd and over the top and beyond the pale his movie. Whereas let's walk it back a little, talking about a movie like Marvel movies, which I have described many times as the McDonald's of movie making. The McDonald's of modern Hollywood. Whereas, you know, it's, you know, you go to McDonald's, you enjoy it, but you don't do it often. And if you did it often, it wouldn't be very healthy. But every once in a while, you know, you're like, oh, I like the way McDonald's tastes. And it's sort of the same thing with a Marvel movie. And I bring this up especially because during his 3-day panel, Zack Snyder mentioned that. He said he and his family watches the Avengers movies and they enjoy them. And he said, you know, there are different types of movies and go and make different types of movies, but these are the movies I'm making. So coming from an objectivist standpoint, the question I have is, where is the line between just enjoying what's out there for what it is and perpetuating a flawed system, the flawed Hollywood system, or just supporting and perpetuating the idea of bad art, you know, naturalism versus romanticism? I mean, we obviously want more romanticism. So did I do something wrong? Did I do something morally wrong, for example, by going to see the movie Us and enjoying being able to laugh at it? Because I don't think I was laughing with it. And I'm probably going to see Avengers Endgame. I didn't see Captain Marvel, but I'm going to see Avengers Endgame. I saw Infinity War. Am I doing something wrong there? Now, we know Zack Snyder wouldn't say I'm doing something wrong. I don't think I'm doing something wrong, but I think many objectivists might say I'm doing something wrong. So I think there's an interesting tension here. What do you guys think?
I don't know. I think you have an easy out, and so does Zack Snyder. And I, you know, this is sort of a cop-out answer, and I'll get to a real one soon, but this is your job in a certain sense, or in a real sense, this is your job. So you do go see these things so you can analyze them and give cultural critique. And Zack Snyder sees them because he's in the business of making superhero movies in a certain sense, and maybe in a, you know, a while ago in a very realistic sense. So you're going to want to know what McDonald's tastes like if you're in the business of making burgers. And it would be a mistake to not understand why McDonald's is successful if you want to create a successful franchise of burgers.
Right. So I kind of was, in a way, almost obligated to see Us. So it's almost good I saw it.
I think so, because you're giving cultural commentary on it. How many people did you stop from seeing it with today's review? So really, they lost money by having you see it. But the point being, I think in a real situation for someone who doesn't do this for a living, someone who's just consuming art for satisfaction, I think there's a clear line. And then I think there's a bunch of unclear lines. And then I think there's a clear line on the other side of it, which is the things that are egregious, i.e.
Black Swan. Black Swan.
That was literally my next one. Black Swan.
Okay. Wow. I just need to say, I'm sure I've said this many times on the show, but Black Swan is like the movie I remember most feeling sick to my stomach while watching.
It's horrific. It's totally disgustingly horrific. Birdman, I think, is maybe another one, although I didn't see it because I thought it was in that category of things. Could be.
Yeah, but Birdman, I didn't feel as sick to my stomach. Birdman, I was just like, really? Somebody made this? And then I got to the end, I was like, oh, of course he dies. Of course he commits suicide. Birdman's more of like, this is really happening right now. And Black Swan is well executed to the point that you're like, this is disgusting. But Birdman's just like, really? This is happening?
Yeah. So I think there are things that are egregious that you should avoid, that are clearly things that are attacks on your values. If you value romanticism, and if you value story and theme and plot and character, and not having to go watch a woke lecture every time you sit down. So, you know, I think those are clear lines. I mean, in the middle are all the things where it might be a particular movie in the Avengers series or the Marvel series that is bad, like Captain America, whereas Iron Man, probably good. Spider-Man, probably good. I don't know. Point being, there are lines there, and then the other side, there are obviously you know, things that definitely support your values, like Sucker Punch, for instance, that you're going to want to go see. So, and you're going to want to patronize them because you want to support them and show that you want more of this kind of thing. Now, all the stuff in the middle is difficult, but maybe that's where you listen to cultural commentary that you trust, and not that you should listen to us as in we are the authorities, or any cultural commentator as they are the authority. But you've at least built a rapport with people who you think share your values and can give intellectually honest evaluations of things. So
before William goes, I just have a follow-up question to what you're saying. I mean, I'm not a chef or anything. So is it immoral that I would have McDonald's every once in a while?
I don't think so. I mean, food is a particularly dangerous one, because I've met some objectivists who are, for instance, no sugar, no grain, who think that the consumption of any sugar whatsoever under any circumstance is immoral. And they think that people who sell sugar are immoral.
Yeah.
Which I think is ludicrous. But if you know, for instance, that sugar is bad, especially like refined sugar, you don't want to consume it more than occasionally. And if you know that McDonald's is bad for you, not necessarily tastes bad, you don't want to consume it every day. And if you are, then you are doing something that is against your self-interest and it is immoral.
Right. And I think the food metaphor works really well, because you're talking about the amount of the ingredients in there. And I think it's the same thing with the movies, right? When you look at Spider-Man Homecoming, that was so far to the social justice side that I think it was not worth watching. Whereas if you look at Infinity War, I think there was enough good in there mixed with the bad that I think it was worth watching. And I think that's why it's difficult to have this line with like things like movies, especially. You know, food a little bit less, but movies especially, because when you're integrating so many complex ideas psychologically and philosophically, it's not all 100% good or bad, where you can simply say, we're going to throw the baby out with the bathwater with this entire movie or this entire film franchise or entire television show. What do you think of that, William?
Yeah, I think I'm going to continue with the food analogy, but first, you can eat healthy at McDonald's. So But we are using it as a stand-in. Yeah, we are using it as a stand-in. But, you know, I this comes up for me.
Wait, hold on. No, I'm not just talking health. I'm talking, right? Like, if I want a great burger, I'm going to go to the counter. But sometimes I just want a triple cheeseburger. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah. Well, to continue, again, to continue with the food analogy, you know, this comes up in my restaurant. I don't screen folks who come through the line to determine their... whether they're white supremacists or homophobic or anything like that. The amount of sanction I'm giving them by serving them is wholly transactional, right? Like, it's just based on that. But, you know, if someone puts a catering order in and wants a delivery and it's a neo-Nazi rally, then maybe I refuse that, right? Most certainly I would, because I don't want to sanction it in that way. So... does that mean that if someone does a pickup catering order that I'm going to research and see what it's for? Probably not. It's very contextual, right? Like, what is the context we're having this discussion in? And that's really the amount of sanction that you're giving, right? I think going to see a movie is a pretty low sanction, right? If you're going to promote the movie, that's a different level of sanction. And if you're going to star in the movie, that's a whole different level of sanction. So you have to look at the effect that you're going to have, and you have to look at what it is that you're really like, how much of this is really a sanction, quote unquote, of the things that are a disvalue to you. In addition to the points you guys are making about how things are in general are mixed.
Right. So I think sort of as summary of all of this, and let me know what you guys think of this. I think it's sort of the difference between Black Panther and a Jordan Peele movie, such as Get Out or Us, where when I watch Black Panther, I think it's one of the more technically well-made Marvel movies. But now you factor in the racial elements, the tribalistic collectivist elements, especially at the end where it's like, we're all a tribe, blah, blah, blah. And that makes it not like 100% I want to give my sanction to it. I'm not going to say like this is a great movie, but it's something where you can go and enjoy watching it because of the better points of it. Whereas there is almost nothing redeeming about Us or Get Out. There's definitely nothing redeeming about Get Out. And there was very few things that were redeeming about Us. And I think... maybe that is the perfect metaphor as far as sanctioning.
Yeah, Justin, I feel the same way about a movie like the director's cut of Donnie Darko. I love that movie on the technical level, right? I hate the theme. So am I sanctioning the movie by talking about that movie and analyzing that movie? Well, yeah, to the extent that it puts the movie together well, right? That part I can super appreciate. The theme I don't appreciate.
Agreed.
Okay, though there you go. I was going to ask what Daniel thought, but he agrees. So let's put a cap on this episode. Let's put a bow on this episode. What did we learn this episode, this trip? Daniel, or no, William. We start with William. William.
I'm not gay enough to run for office.
True. But you hate neo-Nazis, so you're okay.
Oof, maybe. I haven't gone through enough pain in my life, apparently. Someone can judge the amount of pain I've gone through in my life by how much of a lisp I speak with.
Oi.
Daniel?
Well, I researched and learned how to pronounce Pete Buttigieg. So, Buttigieg. Justin?
I think I finally have enough evidence. I know you say it's only movies, Daniel, but I finally have enough evidence to have a definitive conclusion on Jordan Peele. And I also think our discussion on sanction in relation to and supporting... I mean, sanction is such an objectivist buzzword. Just supporting what is antithetical to your values and how to manage that in a world where things are very mixed. I think we had a very great discussion on that, and I feel more comfortable being able to approach what I do, you know, just reviewing and watching movies and caring about narrative and storytelling and just simply existing in this world. I think I feel very more comfortable about that too. So I think this was a good trip for that reason.
Well, we hope you had a good trip here into the Midside, and I'm going to keep this super short this week. Why don't you find us on all the social medias, The Midside, or on our website, themidside.com/podcast, or on patreon.com/themidside, where you can give us a couple bucks. Thanks. Thanks to Liberty.me for syndicating us. Check out their feed and tell a friend about the show. That's how the show grows. That's how more people join the mid-side. Until next week, we love you lots.
This concludes your journey into the mid-side. I'm Justin M. Lesneski reminding you that if things get tough, take a step back and witness the farce.
Have a day. So you know how politicians, you know, like Hillary's famous for speaking in an accent when she's in front of black audiences? Does this candidate need to gay it up in front of Democrat audiences in order to get elected?
When he has a campaign stop in West Hollywood, he better be talking about some musicals.
Yeah, he better be in a he better be shirtless and in a jockstrap. That's what he needs to do.
There you go.
Give us an impersonation real quick. What he has to talk like?
I don't think I can even do it.
Come on.